Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, I hope our phone system stays up today. If there's any glitches, just hang on, or any disruptions in the sound, you know, we'll try to work our way through it. Okay, this has been a very interesting week, to say the least, economically. What's been going on? Well, let's look at Davos, Switzerland. This is the World Economic Forum that's held every January in Davos, Switzerland, and all the big bellies of bankers and business go there, and they sort of talk about the key issues and coordinate their efforts and lots of other politics going on. All the big representatives of government, you know, the financial ministers and so forth, trek to Davos and get to talk to all of them at once, all of them, meaning big business bellies. And, you know, they get to give these ministers their views on what policies should occur in the future or change in the future and what they business sees as the big problems. I'm talking about, you know, multinational corporations, big banks. I'm talking about the big boys. I'm not talking about your mom and pop stuff here. Or even intermediate, you know, it cost about $500,000 last time I looked a couple of years ago to attend, to send one person to attend this. So only the big boys go, you know, and then they bring in entertainment from different places, you know, all these Hollywood and rock star types that became multimillionaires and dabbling either in businesses or in do-gooder stuff. Are brought in to entertain them, and you know it's just a big bash for the big boys. But they do serious communications work there. You know, it's not just a play conference, which they do, of course. And it's been interesting to watch some of the interviews done by Bloomberg News with some of the big names there. You know, the heads of big corporations and shadow banks and. Ministers and central bank heads and so forth, you get a sense of what they're thinking about. I found most interesting, though, an interview of George Soros by Bloomberg. You know, George Soros is this big shadow bank hedge fund guy who broke the bank in the early 90s, broke the British bank, betting on the collapse and driving down the pound, the British pound, and made a couple billion dollars and all that, and went on and kind of the pioneer of big shadow bankers, speculators, and so forth. But you know, his background is not from one of the rich families. You know, he came up from below, was an immigrant himself, and was savvy enough to make himself some money in the system by getting on this early shadow banking wave, hedge fund wave, private equity wave, whatever different forms that it takes, and made himself billions and billions. And you know, he's got this kind of social conscience of sorts, and hasn't really been all that impressed with the state of economic analysis. So he helped pioneer a few years back after the 2008-09 crash, this International Institute of New Economic Thinking in Europe there. And he's often commented on big pictures. You know, he's sort of quasi-retired now. He's not deep into the speculative game, but he knows it well. Anyway, that's enough for a bio for this guy. But, you know, he's up there with all the big ones, has been for some time, and walks and moves in those circles, and oftentimes has a more or less accurate view of where things are going, because he understands the financial system. You see, a lot of these commentators, particularly academics, don't really understand the financial system. They are trained in economic analysis of real variables, GDP and national account variables and so forth. They don't have much of a finance background, and they really don't understand finance. And they are also victims of their own ideological analysis, which characterizes much of mainstream economic thinking. It is so bankrupt today. They actually believe a lot of their falsifications are true, and that's a major reason why they aren't able to forecast the real economy very well. They missed it all in 2008-09, and they missed the slow growth, and they're missing it now as we drift slowly towards stagnation here in crises that we see are erupting more and more. Global oil prices, Chinese stocks and financial system, emerging markets, and so on and so forth. We can go on with that. And I talk about that at great length in my new book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, by Clarity Press, just released this month. You can go to my website or my blog and find out more information on that. The blog is just jackrasmus.com, and the website is kyklosproduction.com, spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com. You can get to the website through the blog. Just click on the bar on the right. It'll take you to the website. And there's three chapters of my book there and introductions and so forth. But anyway, I've been talking about the same thing George Soros is talking about. Gee, George could have written my book. I'm really, really surprised. And so what's George saying? This is interesting because George reflects a certain grouping among the big banking finance elite here. You know, not all of them share his views, but his views tend to be more right than their views have been. So what has he been saying? What's George been saying? Well, very, very interesting here. First of all, he says, and I'm going to quote some of his comments because they were so interesting in his interview with Bloomberg on TV. I wrote them down. So let's see what George is saying here. As part of our tour of events of the week. Of course, Davos World Economic Forum is a major event of the past week. Okay, here's some topics. One, on the crisis, 2008 and today, and 2015-16. He says that we are repeating the financial crisis and the bear market. Financial bear market. That's a quote from him, right? The difference is in 2008-09, it was subprime mortgages. Now, 15-16, it's China as the root cause. China, where the total debt in China is well over 300% of GDP. In other words, China's debt is over $30 trillion. And, you know, virtually all that debt, well, at least $25 trillion of it, has been accumulated since 2009 in China. Yes, massive debt run-up in China. And it's being covered up. A lot of it has to do with the shadow banking system in China. There's about 5,000, 6,000 shadow banks in China. And they're not reporting things. And the Chinese government is not requiring them to reveal the problems and the depth of the debt situation there. A debt that's so massive it can't really be financed. In other words, finance meaning paying interest and principal on it. That's a problem in Europe as well, where they admit just the 100 largest banks have over $1 trillion in non-performing bank loans, and they're not being reported. They're allowing the banks not to report them, not to report those losses. And if you look at what's happening behind the scenes here in European banks, they're all pulling in. The big banks are pulling in their claws. Barclays Bank, Deutsche Bank, all of them are selling off assets and laying off workers, which is a sign that they're trying to raise cash in order to cover their losses that aren't being adequately reported. And this past week, in particular, we're seeing some of this emerge. You know, once in a while, the truth sort of erupts, bubbles up here and there. They can't keep a lid on it everywhere. Well, this last week, we see the Italian banks are in particular problem unable to finance their loans. Finance meaning you either roll over the bad loans when they come due, or you take another loan out to pay the bad loans. An alternative to doing that is defaults. Anyway, a large amount of non-performing loans in Europe, maybe $1.5 trillion at least, and in China, another $2.5 trillion non-performing loans. That's $4 trillion in loans, bank loans that's not paying principal and interest. And this is, you know, before we start seeing the big defaults coming in the oil patch here, which is going to be on the headline news here this year. Even Saudi Arabia is trying to launch a public company of its oil production to raise money. You see, when you go IPO, you raise money, and somebody, you know, they buy shares in the thing and so forth. In other words, Saudi Arabia can't make enough money from the sale of oil because the price is so low in order to pay interest in debt in its budget, to cover its budget, its social budget. So it's got to let other people and big capitalists around the world buy a piece of the action there in Saudi Arabia. There are signs everywhere beginning to creep up that there's a growing problem in anticipation of inability to pay existing debt. You know, $2.5 trillion in non-performing loans in China, $1.5 trillion at least in Europe. How much in Japan? I don't know. In the U.S.? I don't know yet. I haven't looked up those numbers, but certainly emerging markets, you know, Latin America and Asia, even Africa, you know, they're certainly got a lot of non-performing loans as well. That are being covered up. You know, we could be anywhere between $5 and $10 trillion in non-performing loans. Well, what happens if we go into a recession? And which, by the way, Morgan Stanley forecasted for the U.S. 50-50 chance now of recession this year. 50-50. And the Atlanta Federal Reserve forecast that in the fourth quarter of last year, the U.S. GDP grew at only 0.6%, less than 1%, in other words. Growth has collapsed here, if it's true, according to the Atlanta Federal Reserve. This quarter is going to be even worse. Oh, this will make it the fifth time in 5 years that the U.S. economy has elapsed to near zero in terms of growth rate, the fifth time. I mean, this is a real pattern going on, isn't it? Four times, nearly 0% growth. You know, even after they doctored up the GDP numbers to add intellectual property to it all and add $500 billion a year to GDP, which is just phony number, paper numbers. Even so, you know, still only growing 0.6%. By the way, that phony paper numbers is about $500 billion a year in GDP and a 0.3% of GDP. So, you know, if the economy is only growing 0.6% last fourth quarter, it's really 0.3% last quarter. You know, if you back out those doctoring, and all these countries, as I talked before, are doctoring up their GDP numbers. All right, so U.S. economy is a little shaky, but let's get back to George. Get back to George here. By the way, I will be writing about the U.S. economy here in the future and talking about it more as I look at the numbers again at the beginning of this year, the first quarter, and make some prediction as to where the U.S. economy is going. But you can guess what I'm going to predict. I'm going to predict another relapse coming. All right. So let's go back to George. George was talking about George Soros here, about we're on a course for repeating the crisis of 2008. This time it's going to be situated in China. You know, there's a lot of talk going on now, and you can see them all chattering about it at the World Economic Forum, Davos, about whether China is going to have a hard landing. Hard landing meaning its GDP is going to decline faster than the official reported, 6.8% now for the fourth quarter last year. And, you know, they're still predicting the banks and so forth, 6.5% growth this year. No way. No way. Talk about doctoring up statistics here. You know, all, and not just me, this isn't a conspiracy argument by any means, but everybody in most of the research institutions of the West have big doubts about that 6.8%. In fact, George Soros says he believes it's not growing any more than 3.5% in China. Wow. In other words, half of what they're reporting. Sounds like Indian statistics. You know, I've talked to Indian finance guys, and they say, well, we just take the official government figures and half them, and that's probably what we're growing. Well, it looks like China's about the same way. Maybe all of Asia's that, you know. Maybe that's the Asian adjustment factor here for growth, you know. Take whatever they say and cut it in half, and you're probably closer to it. Anyway, George says a hard landing is unavoidable, meaning it's not going to slowly decline. It's in a more rapid decline going on in China right now, and China's the big problem. And when he was asked, well, is that your forecast? He says, no, I'm observing it. I'm observing the hard landing going on. He goes on to add that China can manage the hard landing, however, because it has over $3 trillion in reserves. But he also added they have a way, they will probably pass it on to the rest of the world. You know, they'll export their hard landing and their decline to the rest of the world through the deflation factor. And, you know, what's going on with the stock market and the currency there are just examples of the deportation of the crisis to the rest of the world. Soros believes a big problem is deflation going on, and there's three sources of major causes of deflation in the world. One is China, which is happening, of course. Another is oil and commodity prices, and another is competitive devaluations. I've been talking about that for some time now, how Europe and Japan are engaging in these tit-for-tat competitive quantitative easing, massive injections of money into their economy, which is then picked up by speculators and investors who then buy stocks with the free money. And, of course, what happens is it drives up stock and bond prices, you know. And we've seen this past week, by the way. We've seen exactly that. We had all this crisis last week, the week before, with China stocks and fear of China devaluation going on. And then all of a sudden it stabilized a little bit this week. Why did it stabilize? Because they're talking, the big boys, are talking up the system. How are they doing that? Well, the chair of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, once again gave one of his signals here that we're going to have more QE in March. More QE in March. And right away, the stock markets in the U.S. and Europe stabilized. They stopped their decline. You know, they got a little bounce up. They'll go down again, but, you know, just talking you up and the prospect of more free money coming in March out of Europe, and in other words, more free money to speculate in financial assets, had the effect of stabilizing things. At the same time, China leaked rumors that it may engage in another fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus. And that kind of stabilized the markets a little bit in China. So this combination of China leaking a stimulus and Draghi publicly stating more QE stopped the fall, stopped the free fall. Well, I've been predicting that either China or Japan would do more QE, and whichever one went first, the other one would follow. And it's almost for certain, even though the chair of the central bank over there in Japan, Kuroda, says we're going to wait and see. Yeah, they're going to wait and see what exactly happens in March with Europe. If Europe does QE, then they're going to do it too, because QE is designed to drive down your currency and give yourself a little bit of a competitive price advantage for your exports. That's another effect of it, other than the money flowing into financial assets, stock and bond markets. But that's competitive valuations in QE are directly linked. So Japan's waiting and watching Europe, and both of them are watching the U.S. Because in March, the U.S. Central Bank, Janet Yellen, chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank, is going to have to decide whether she's going to raise rates again a little 0.25% or not. You know, the signals have been out of the Fed that, yeah, we're going to have some further very careful rate increases, short-term rate increases. We've had one here in December, and then all the talk was a month ago that there would be a series of three further rate increases in 2016, the first of which would come in March. Well, you know, they're all watching the Fed and watching Europe now. Europe's going to go with a QE. So will the U.S. raise rates? You know, U.S. is going one direction, Europe's going the other in terms of central bank policy. No, the Fed won't raise rates now. They can't, because everything's getting weaker. And by the time the Fed meets to make a decision, we'll have 2 months, January, February, of this year of U.S. economic activity, and it will look weak, I predict, and the Fed will have to back off, you see. All this talk about job creation here in the U.S., jobs are a lagging indicator. I mean, the job growth is a reflection of U.S. economic activity of last September, October, you know, maybe even August. That's what the jobs are. It's at least a three-month lagging indicator. And we're going to start seeing now, come this spring, March, April, unemployment claims rising and the job growth figures declining from their roughly 250,000 to 75,000 a month. By the way, that 275,000 a month is suspect, and much of it, I believe, is part-time temp contingent contract kind of jobs that don't bring much income, you see, wage income, which is still stagnating here in the U.S. And while everybody feels, you know, the recovery still isn't affecting average folks. That's why average middle-class, working-class folks are pissed off. That's why they're turning as a protest to Trump and to Sanders. Sanders is surging on all over and may actually win Iowa or New Hampshire in his contest with Hillary. You know, and already the Democrat establishment's getting worried and trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do here? Of course, they can always stop him. He will never get the nomination of the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party is very undemocratic, and they have what they call the superdelegates. And that's a third of all those who will be voting for the candidate to be their nominee. And, you know, those are in the pocket there, the Democratic establishment. They'll never let Sanders. It was naive of him to think he could ever get the nomination, you know. That's why I haven't supported his position yet. If he runs independent, of course I will. But I won't support his position here running as a Democrat, which is really a hypothetical, which won't happen. In any event, Trump is having the same effect on the other end, isn't he? You know, and he's pulling in a lot of working class, conservative working class votes as well. People are just upset with the two wings of the one corporate party in this country called Republicans and Democrats, and you see the U.S. electorate kind of stretching out on both ends. It's going to be a very interesting season here before we get too far, and I'll be writing on that more as well and talking about that, starting with the role of money in politics. Yeah, it's recently come out that Hillary took $2 million in speaking fees from the big banks just in 1 month or 1 week. I forget what it is, 1 week or 1 month. I think it was you know, she's getting like $250,000 a speech, and she's not beholden to the banks. Come on. Nobody gives you that kind of money unless they want something for it in return. Right? Okay, so that's the U.S. electorate. Let's get back to George, because George Soros has some other interesting comments. I just gave you his view on the hard landing coming in China. Right? Hard landing. And what else does he have to say about the global economy? Well, he believes that the Eurozone is in an existential crisis, quote-unquote, right? That it's quite likely something has gone totally wrong, he says. And it's about to pull apart, the final straw here being all this migration into Europe, you know. Well, the Europeans deserve it. The big boys, you know, who built this neoliberal shaky edifice over there in the Eurozone, they deserved it. What do I mean by that? Well, you know, why do they have all this immigration coming? Well, you know, they followed NATO and U.S. lead, and they went and bombed the hell out of Libya and bombed the hell out of Syria and everything. And of course, the people, you know, are marching into Europe to save their ass because of all the crisis and disruption caused by this regime change policies, you know, led by the U.S., led by the neocons in the U.S., NATO, and so forth. Europe has no foreign policy. Europe is just an appendage of the U.S. in that regard, and has been for years now. So they're reaping the whirlwind that they sowed here, disrupting all this, you know, and they don't know how to stop the people, right? There's this big factor when the masses and people take political action, whether it's in migration or whatever, you know, they're really at a loss. It's very difficult for them to deal with it. And that's what's happening in Europe. And, you know, George Soros sees this and he says, okay, we got a problem here. Europe is already fragile. The Eurozone, and this may just be enough to pull it apart. Well, we'll see. He may or may not be wrong about this, but time will certainly tell. Okay. As far as QE is concerned, George recognizes, as more and more do now, that QE works for whom? Works for pumping up the financial asset markets. You know, the whole idea of QE was to make the rich even richer through price appreciation in stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth, in the hope that there'd be what's called a wealth effect, which means they'll take their riches and maybe invest a little bit here and there to create real jobs instead of financial assets, and maybe people will get a little bit of more income. And with that little bit of more income, maybe they'll spend some of it, and that will boost the economy. That was the whole strategy of the Fed, you see. That's a monetary supply-side top-down strategy, you know, trickle-down strategy, monetary supply-side strategy. You know, under Reagan, it was a real investment supply-side strategy, but here, you know, it's a monetary supply-side strategy. And they love these supply-side strategies and approaches because it makes the rich richer and it trickles down, maybe. Of course, now it's just a drip-drip. Monetary supply-side produces even less of a boost to the real economy than a real economic supply-side, you know, that was pioneered by Reagan and Thatcher. They don't like to engage in government fiscal spending, you know, infrastructure and all those things, because that's all designed to create jobs and put money in the hands of the middle class and the working class, who will then spend it, and that way indirectly make the rich richer. You know, that takes longer and it's more uncertain. They don't like that fiscal side approach. So, you know, they've replaced that with austerity, fiscal austerity, and they're all focusing on the monetary side now. And that's been going on for some time here, especially since 2008. There's a consensus among all the global business elite that, you know, we want to do this monetary supply side driven by the central banks, liquidity injections, QE, and so on and so forth. Well, Soros says, you know, QE worked for them, of course, but it's even there having diminishing returns. In other words, it's more and more QE. It takes more and more QE to get even financial assets moving again in an upward trajectory, more and more. Studies by different Federal Reserve Bank, I think it was St. Louis, Fed had this study that showed that for every dollar of QE, U.S. QE, it only provided 25 cents of real investment that created jobs and so forth. Most of it went to financial speculation or went offshore. Or still hoarded on bank and corporate balance sheets, or it was returned to shareholders in $8 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, right? And the rest shuffled off into tax shelters around the world or held on balance sheets where they pay a little bit of taxes on the whole thing. That's the game going on now. You know, huge wealth. That's why we have all this income inequality. You know, income inequality can occur because the vast number of wage earners just aren't making getting wage increases or having jobs or suffering cuts to their wages or benefits. You know, you can have that result in the very wealthy 1% getting a greater relative share of the total national income pie. Or you can have those at the top, you know, making obscene profits and therefore income gains from all this speculation. And that's been happening too. You see, we have a double whammy going on here. The bottom stagnant and dropping, and the top escalating faster and faster, that causes this big gap. And as studies have shown, I've said before, we're saying again on this show that 95% of all the net income gains in the U.S. since 2009 have gone to the 1%. And the vast majority of that has gone to the 0.1%. Okay. It's a real economic plutocracy, and they're making sure they change the political system and institutions, Citizens United and all that, so they can hold on to all this, you see, because when you have those kind of problems, no growth and income inequality, people get upset, you know, a la Trump and Sanders support, and you know, they start saying why and start challenging and using the democratic system to do something about it. Well, you know, you got to bias that democratic system to prevent that. And that's going on as well in parallel. You know, it's not unrelated to the crisis, right? It's not by accident that Citizens United was passed in 2010, you know, 18 months after the crisis. They knew resistance was coming, and they're going to try to control it by finding a way to deep six the Trumps and the Sanders, right? And they're going to use their political party machines to try to deny them the nominations and let those two guys hang out there as third parties and paper them over as extremists, both of them. And therefore not in the mainstream. But, you know, the American people are getting tired of the mainstream. Yeah, it's not producing for them. And it's producing excessively for the 1%. So they're getting tired of that. You know, people aren't blind. They can see what's happening after 6 years. Well, what else does our friend George Soros have to say? Well, I mentioned deflation was the big problem he sees. And, yes, I talk about that in my book as well. Right? The lack of real investment is a consequence of this shift. In my book, I argue to financial investment and speculation. This is going on global. That is escalating. financial investment is escalating, causing bubbles, and the bubbles pop, and other bubbles come, and they pop, you know, and each time they make money out of the bubbles. That's escalating, but it's sucking money capital, real money capital, out of what ordinarily would go into real asset investment. When you have slowing and declining real asset investment, well, that means you start getting deflation, disinflation and deflation in goods and services that are produced by those real assets. And if people don't make income gains, they don't spend as much unless they can get debt, credit and debt, which is most of where consumption is coming from now. It's not real wage gains. That slows down the growth of goods and service prices as well. And so you get this deflation in goods and prices. At the same time, you get inflation in financial assets. So deflation and inflation. I call this in my book DEF inflation, D-E-F inflation. DEF, in other words, both occurring at the same time. Financial asset price inflation occurring and deflation occurring on goods and prices. And occasionally even the financial asset prices go bust, like we see in global oil prices, which are a financial security, oil futures, not just a real physical commodity. So you got to look at it from a financial point of view. Stock contractions going on, right? That's deflation. The bubbles occur. You know, we definitely had a bubble in China here, and it's being deflated. It's already wiped out about $5 trillion in paper values and currency paper values over in China. And estimates, the latest I've seen, just since the beginning of the year, as the Chinese bubble, stock bubble deflation, has begun impacting Western stock markets as well, U.S. stock market down about 10%. Estimates are just since January 1st, about $7.8 trillion in stock values have been wiped out globally. Oil prices are at the lowest in 12 years. You know, they hit $27 a barrel here. Predictions are they're going to go, by the way, to even less. Some are predicting $20 a barrel. I read that up in Canada, you know, the big crisis in oil, tar sands up there, oil selling for $15 a barrel. And I even saw somewhere offer to purchase the poorest grade, and it was high sulfur grade oil up in Canada for 50 cents a barrel. Okay. So we have the asset bubbles collapsing in stock market now globally, as well as in oil and commodity prices. Most commodity prices, aluminum, iron, copper, and so forth, are down 30 to 60%. That's approaching depression level. And of course, we have this 80% decline in oil, which is a depression level. Producer prices, commodity producer prices, are in the depression level. Well, no wonder George Soros is worried, sees the, you know, these extreme bubbles popping while others are really beginning. We have hundreds of billions of dollars flowing out of China. The International Institute of Finance here recently estimated that in 2015 we had about $750 billion of capital flight out of China and emerging markets. This is only the beginning. Capital flight. Well, you can't have that much capital flight out without serious contractions of the real economy going on in those areas. And as I've said, I agree with George. The crisis, next crisis, is going to originate in China. But because China has all these assets, it'll be able to deal with it, but it will export it, and the crisis will really be felt in emerging markets. That's where it's going to be centered. It's not going to be in U.S. banks. Of course, European banks may be part of that crisis eventually, since they're sitting on so many bad loans. But it's going to be centered in emerging markets. And that's largely because emerging markets today just don't have the reserves that China has to deal with the collapse, to weather the collapse. And also, emerging markets, a lot of their debt that has occurred, over $25 trillion at least, in a run-up of debt in emerging markets since 2010, much of that is in dollars, which is a proof and an indication of this money that flowed out of the U.S. with QE in 2009-13. A lot of it went to emerging markets, as well as financial speculation. But if you look at the dollarized value of the debt in emerging markets, it's $4 trillion of the corporate debt. And it's corporate debt. You see, the problem is corporate debt. It's not consumer debt. It's not even government debt yet. Governments will have defaults eventually in emerging markets. But the big problem is all this massive corporate debt that's built up. The Bank of International Settlements estimated at the end of 2013 that there had been a $40 trillion increase in total debt since 2007. In other words, the debt hasn't been controlled. The debt has grown, escalated, especially on the business side, where always the massive debt increases occurs. It's not the consumers, and it's not even government. Government debt is a reflection of an attempt to try to transfer to government balance sheets the problems of corporate debt. But we have this massive debt buildup, and $4 trillion of it's in dollars, which means that these emerging markets have to sell exports and get dollars in order to just pay the principal and interest on that $25 trillion in debt. By the way, the Bank of International Settlements, $40 trillion, was the number at the end of 2013. I think it's at least $50 trillion today. $50 trillion in debt, maybe more. And much of that, most of that, is in emerging markets and in China. And a lot of the ability to pay for it is declining. You've got to earn exports, and the global market trade is slowing rapidly. It may even be stagnant now. There may be no growth. You know, because the only figures, official figures we have are a year ago, and a lot has happened since a year ago, and I think the global trade, you know, the global economy in terms of trade may be stagnant. We certainly know that the manufacturing and industrial production sector is in recession globally, and trade may be globally. So all these emerging markets are going to have to earn money by selling exports into a shrinking global economy. Of course, they're going to reduce their currencies, aren't they? Just like the Europeans and the Japanese are. So we have this three-way competition, competitive devaluations by QE and massive money injections into the economies going on and continuing. And by the way, I believe that China is going to have to devalue as well. Even though it keeps its currency sort of pegged to the dollar, that currency is at the lower band of that peg. And there's no way they can prevent the yuan from declining value further in the coming year, which is going to destabilize everything even further. It's going to cause more capital flight out of China and a further collapse of the stock market in China. If you have a further devaluation, then there's no way the Chinese cannot have a further devaluation. Talk is a devaluation somewhere between 10 and 20% coming further in China. That means they're going to have to abandon the peg, just as other countries in trouble are abandoning their peg to the dollar, Saudi Arabia and others. Right? It's all coming unhinged. You know, the currencies are coming unhinged, and financial markets are cracking and shaking, and economies are slowing down, and this massive debt, mountain of debt, sits there saying, well, I don't care whether you got problems. You have to still keep making your payments of principal and interest, you know. And Argentina and Brazil say, well, how are we going to do that? We can't sell our exports to get dollars because we got to pay you out in dollars because most of our debt is dollarized, $4 trillion of it. China's in the same boat, right? Maybe $1 trillion of that $4 trillion is dollarized debt. meaning you got to pay it off in dollars, meaning you got to increase exports in order to earn the dollars to pay it off, meaning you got to devalue your currency, meaning you got to do more QE, which even adds more to the total debt. You see, it's a downward spiral, right? They can't get their hands around it. And they see it slipping out, and you can see, Chinese policymakers having trouble with it all. It's sort of slipping away from them, and growing lack of confidence that they got the thing under control, even though they say they do. They got it under control. Those are just words. Look at the real numbers behind the words, and that tells you more. Well, certainly the European and Mario Draghi have lost control of it all, haven't they? Yes. More QE, more QE, more QE. That's all they can think about, right? By the way, I heard that, Wolfgang Schäuble, you know, this head man of the big bankers in Germany and elsewhere who sort of led the attack on Greece, are now beginning to have some thought, well, maybe we need some fiscal stimulus here, right? Maybe we need to. Well, that's going to be more government debt. At the same time, Europe has to come up with money. How are they going to deal with all of these disruptions or all these immigrants coming in? Europe is a basket case. And all those arrogant Brits who thought, well, you know, we're different. Nothing's, you know, our economy is growing. Yeah, not anymore. Not anymore. It's not, you know, it was all based on property speculation and foreign inflow of direct investment, China and elsewhere, and all that is now up for grabs. So Britain's beginning to sink. Yeah, all of Europe is in trouble. And George is right, therefore. You know, they're heading for an existential crisis. This Greek debt thing is going to erupt again, no doubt about that. By the way, I have another new book coming out this spring called Looting Greece, The New Financial Imperialism. You know, a new kind of colonialism in the smaller economies of the advanced economic sectors, Europe, North America, Asia. A new kind of imperialism and colonialism where you extract wealth from these periphery countries like Greece through financial banking system means and interest paid on debt that never goes away and grows interest, extracting value. You know, Greek people are going to have to work like hell now in order to keep paying interest to these northern European banks. Well, that's a form of colonialism. You know, it used to be the old model, the old British model. You know, you go conquer India or someplace like that, and you make people work real cheap, making cotton and all these things, and you sell it to London at a cheap price, and then London resells it, to Europe and elsewhere at a higher price. And so they're extracting that surplus value from production, from workers in India. That was the old classical model. Then you had to keep a bureaucracy there and some kind of an army to keep them down every time they sort of revolted. Well, the new imperialism has nothing to do with that. New imperialism is all financial. And it's a new form of colonialism, but it's the same because it extracts wealth out of these countries back to the colonizer country. In this case, in Europe, it's Germany and Holland and those northern bankers. Okay, so that's another new book, Looting Greece, coming out May 1st, right? But right now, my timely book just came out, which is Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. I mean, George Soros could have wrote it here. George, you want to review my book? Yeah, okay, George. Somehow we got to let you know that you and I are in sync. I just wish I had some of your money. Okay. Global recession, deflation, and global economy is slowing, right? And deflation makes the global slowdown even worse, right? He does say he didn't want to sound so negative. He did say, but I see the light at the end of the tunnel. I just don't know how to get there. Okay, George, you reflect your class and the conundrum that they're facing here. And even when they're positive, they don't know how to get to the positive, right? It was interesting, too, that he jumped into this attack on Trump, right, by the elites going on right now. Trump is doing the work of ISIS, he said. Right? Oh, boy, I mean, what else could you say? You know, what does that mean? Trump is a terrorist? If he's doing the work of ISIS, go arrest him, right? I mean, they arrest a lot of poor folks for even unknowingly contributing money to some organization that's a front group for, you know, these terrorist groups, and people don't even know they're doing that, and, of course, they get labeled and arrested. Well, you know, if Trump is doing the work for it, why don't they go arrest him? So that's an interesting comment that he had to say. Right. Well, another thing he pointed out was this book by Adair Turner, who is the guy who is running his Institute of New Economic Thinking in Europe, and just had a book out in which Turner says that the difference between now and 1930s is that we're going into the next crisis bigger in debt than we did in 2008, or that we did in 1929. We're more in debt, but therefore the difficulty is even greater. You know, QE bailed out the big boys here in 2008-09, but with this massive debt having accumulated now, and I estimate somewhere between $20-30 trillion has been pumped in to the global economy by the Fed and other central banks. $20-30 trillion. And as I said before, where's that gone? It hasn't gone into real asset investment in jobs and incomes. It's gone into financial speculation. Or for a while, for 2010-12, it went out into emerging markets. And that money is coming back now, leaving emerging markets high and dry. You know, or it was given $8 trillion given to shareholders, the stockholders, in buybacks, which is still going on. Or $5 trillion of it was spent in merger and acquisitions, which destroys jobs, doesn't create them. Right? Or it went into shelters, tax inversions, corporate tax inversions, you know, and offshore shelters all around the world. Or it's still sitting on corporate balance sheets in record levels, despite having disbursed, you know, $10-15 trillion and spent $5 trillion in mergers and acquisitions, and experienced a double and more increases in stock prices. You know, global stock values increased from 2007, $32 trillion to $64 trillion today. So $32 trillion in just stock price appreciation. And, of course, that doesn't even count corporate bonds or foreign exchange speculation or derivatives, which we don't know about because it's opaque, right? We still don't know about derivatives. Right? Okay. By the way, George also believes, as I believe, that the yuan has to be and will be devalued further, and that's going to destabilize everything. No matter what the Chinese policymakers say, it's what they do. All right? He's very negative on China, not surprisingly. Others at Davos were not so negative on China. You know, they said, well, it's going to be a soft landing. It's not going to be a hard landing. And others say, well, you know, they talk past themselves and they say, well, it's going to be a bumpy. Sometimes hard, sometimes soft. You know, whatever the hell that means. Right? So, EME capital flight is a big problem. Talk about that report released this past week. The International Institute of Finance, you know, big corporate billionaire funding organization admitted to $732 billion capital flight, net capital flight last year out of emerging markets in China. That's probably the bottom estimate. I think it's at least $1 trillion in capital flight. Probably at least, in China, at least two-thirds of that coming out of China. Where's that money going, by the way? Oh, well, you know, it's going into properties. Yes, these rich Chinese are cashing out as fast as they can out of their stock, and they're buying dollars, causing downward pressure on their currency. You know, because they're selling it, increases the supply of yuan, drives down the price. A lot of that's happening in these offshore currency hubs, you know, like Hong Kong and Singapore and elsewhere. The Chinese are trying, policymakers are trying to put a damper on that, and with some success, but only temporarily. But the money, you know, a lot of $1 trillion is flowing out of China. And where's it going? It's going into properties, you know. Properties where? Well, Vancouver, California, Australia, London, Frankfurt. Okay, this is where the money is flowing to. And they're buying cash. They're bringing piles of cash over, you know, like bagmen. And they're buying cash, buying these properties with cash when they turn it into dollars. Okay, and causing, you know, bubbles at the high end of the markets, the property markets, you know, or they're buying small companies, medium-sized companies with it, you know, to get a financial base. But, you know, Asians love property investments whenever they can. So that's where a lot of the money is going, or it's going into shelters, shelters, you know, around the world, outside of China, and you know, that's a big trend here, an important trend. Capital flight. It's another indication of growing instability. Currency volatility, another indication. Stock and bond market collapse, another indication. Oil and commodities price collapse, another indication. All these are accumulating indicators now of growing instability in the financial markets around the world. At some point, you know, these things will converge. And the investors, the new finance capital elite, I call them in my book, behind all this, are going to take their money and put it into cash and sit on it. And when that happens, you know, it's going to the collapse of financial asset prices will occur even more vigorously. And when that happens, you have a collapse, you have a credit crunch, you have the credit crises, solvency crises, defaults, you know, which drives down financial assets even more. And then it spills over to the real economy as the real economy freezes up and we start getting layoffs, slowing down the production and employment, and already with prices disinflating and deflating in Europe and Japan, that means even further deflation in goods and services prices, alongside now the deflation in financial asset prices, which becomes generalized. You know, economists say, oh, you know, the price system stabilizes the system, you know, an economy. That's such nonsense. You know, prices destabilize the system, destabilize it. They aren't this thing that equilibrates, returns to equilibrium. That's such a fiction, you know, but all these economic students are taught this nonsense all the time still. You know, it's like 200 years old and has nothing to do with financial asset prices. Okay, that's it for today. We'll keep looking at the global economy, which is going to be very interesting here. I'm sure, you know, a little stability here for a while is going to erupt again, and we'll see where it goes. This is Jack Rasmussen, Current Divisions.